the Koch family fortune, about some of their operations, about groups like this. This is a service, in essence, that we're offering to the public to make sure that they can learn more about the Koch brothers. They can learn more about these groups that change their names or pop up here and there, and they can help trace the dark money that is being pushed into our elections. As was reported earlier this year, there's been an effort to increase the sophistication of that operation in the 2014 Senate races and governor's races across the country. And so we think it's important for people to know who these Koch brothers are, who these billionaires are.
We're going to have to leave it there. Lisa Graves is president of the Progressive, Inc. And that does it for our broadcast. We have two job openings, administrative director as well as a Linux administrator. I'm Amy Goodman with Aaron Mate. Our website is democracynow.org.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, where the time is now 8:01. Coming up next is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show with our host, Abe Proctor and Joe Uris. Today, we'll take on the new, improved Gilded Age.
I'm Monica Beamer.
And I'm Mike Crenshaw. We're KBOO's new co-station managers. We're excited to be a part of the KBOO community. We're starting a new weekly feature on Wednesdays at 5:45 p.m. News from the Boo will give you an inside look into what's happening at KBOO, including upcoming events, station news, special programming, and future goals and plans for the station.
Be sure to tune in this Wednesday and every Wednesday after the KBOO Evening News for News from the Boo, an insider look into your community radio station.
KBOO is proud to co-sponsor the second annual Debtors Assembly Portland on Saturday, July 12th from 3 to 6 p.m. at Holiday Park, located at Northeast 11th and Holiday near the Lloyd Center MAX stop. Hosted by Strike Debt Portland, the Debtors Assembly will be a public gathering of neighbors and community leaders, seeing debt in a new way, one of social justice. Experts will speak on how the debt industries work and how they enable poverty and wealth inequality. And finally, organizers will lead group conversation on building creative ideas for local collective resistance against unjust debts. Again, at Saturday, July 12th at 3 p.m. in Holiday Park. More information may be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
I've traveled around this country from shore to shining shore. It really made me wonder the things I heard and saw. I saw the weary farmer a plowing sod and loam. I heard the auction hammer just a knocking down his home. But the banks are made of marble with a guard at every door. And the bolts are stuffed with silver that the farmer sweated for. I've seen the seamen standing idly by the shore, and I heard their bosses saying, "Got no work for you no more." But the banks are made of marble with a guard at every door. And the vaults are stuffed with silver that the seamen sweated for. I've seen the weary miner scrubbing coal dust from his back, and I've heard his children crying, "Got no coal to heat the shack. But the banks are made of marble, with a guard at every door. And the vaults are stuffed with silver that the miners sweated for. I've seen my brothers working throughout this mighty land. I've prayed we'd get together and together make a stand. Then we might own those banks of marble with a guard at every door. And we would share those vaults of silver that we have sweated for.
Good morning. This is KBOO 90.7 on your FM dial.
It is. I'm Abe and you're Joe. And
that's true. Abe Proctor, Joe Uris.
This is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio program.
It makes sense. 231.
It does.
8187.
We're clever like that.
231-8187. Clever? I doubt it. Okay. What are we talking about?
We're talking about the Great Recession.
Yay!
And the New Gilded Age.
Yeah.
Really, they're one and the same.
Yes.
They're two sides of a coin.
Mm-hmm.
And now that I've belabored that monetary metaphor, I'll move on.
Okay.
About 6 years ago, 2008, as is widely known, the bottom fell out of the global economy.
Yes.
There are a number of factors at play here, a number of growing instabilities in a system that, because of the regulatory restrictions that had been removed from it, was not a sustainable financial structure.
Right.
Primarily, the cause of the collapse was the bursting of the mortgage derivatives bubble. A lot of people hear these terms tossed around, but they're not quite clear what they are. So very quickly, I'm going to explain what that means.
Okay.
Okay. So what do you do when you want to buy a house, Joe?
When I want to buy a house,
yeah.
I take my vast fortune and use it as a down payment.
Okay. I'm sorry. Are you one of the Koch brothers?
Yeah.
Okay.
Sure.
What, if you're an ordinary person and you want to buy a house, what do you do?
Well, you find the house and you go to a mortgage broker or a bank or whatever, and you try to arrange a mortgage for that house.
Right. So you procure a loan.
Yeah.
You borrow some money, you buy a house.
Yeah.
That's called a mortgage.
Yeah.
You are obligated to pay that back.
Yeah.
So in an abstract sense, a mortgage is your promise to pay, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So we got you, Joe, your promise to pay back the loan you've taken out for the house that you're living in.
Yeah.
There's millions of other Joes around the country.
Yeah.
They've all made a promise to pay back the money on the house that they're living in.
Yeah.
Right. That's a typical mortgage arrangement.
Yeah.
Now, a mortgage derivative happened when some genius at a trading house in New York, probably, said, look, we've got all these promises to pay back money. All of these mortgages out there. What if we took all of these things?
Yeah, they're worth money, potentially.
They're worth money, potentially. We put them all together. We cut them up into a bunch of pieces, and we start selling those pieces off to people.
Ah.
So now you've got a promise to pay on a promise to pay. You're a couple steps removed from reality now. Those are mortgage derivatives. Those were largely unregulated at the time because they were brand new. They were a new innovative financial instrument, as the masters of the universe liked to say at the time. And they traded like hotcakes. There were no controls on them. And of course, there really wasn't anything there. You were selling pieces of a whole bunch of other people's promises to pay back money.
Right.
And so when people started calling these things due, there wasn't anything there. There was a bunch of nothing, and it all came crashing down, and the government stepped in to try and stop the bleeding.
Well, and of course, in the midst of this, there was a reevaluation upward of properties that was not realistic.
No, there was not. And there was also there were a lot of loans made to people who really weren't in a position to repay them.
In fact, they were frequently pressured or talked into buying more property than they could afford.
Right, exactly. And this, these were essentially,
pardon me.
This was the financial industry playing both ends of the game. They were lending money to homeowners that they were going to get back based on that promise to pay. But at the same time, they were making money on the back end of that deal because they were selling off these mortgage derivatives left and right.
Right.
So it made sense for them in the short term to loan money to people who couldn't pay back the loans because they were immediately making a whole bunch of extra cash. And I'm sure even those of you without a formal economic education, which is, let's face it, almost all of us, can understand that that's not going to keep on working.
Well, but as long as people have, this is true in any financial instrument, as long as people believe that it's valuable, then it's valuable in its impact or effect.
Well, that's true of the entire economy.
Yeah.
Here's the big secret. You ready for the big secret?
I'm ready for the big secret. I'm not ready for the big secret. Oh, now I'm ready for the big secret.
The entire global economy functions because we have all agreed to believe it should function.
Yes.
Okay.
I agree.
All right.
All right.
503-231-8187 is the number to call today. That's how the mortgage derivative collapse happened. That was the big blow to the economy. That's what caused the collapse of Lehman Brothers, of Bear Stearns. And then the government decided to step in and save any of the other big trading houses from collapsing because they realized at that moment that there was very little standing between the economy and the abyss of another Great Depression.
Right.
So the taxpayers stepped in. They bailed out a number of the large trading houses. They stepped in and essentially nationalized General Motors and took a number of stopgap measures that more or less staved off a second Great Depression, but left us in a situation that has become, 6 years removed now from the Great Crash of 2008, the new normal, in which the jobs we at one time took for granted in this country that led to a prosperous middle class are now gone. Wages have remained almost entirely stagnant, even going back many years before the crash of 2008. And in the meantime, in the so-called economic recovery that has gone on, almost all of those gains have been captured by the very highest levels of the economic scale.
Yes, hence Occupy with its 1% of 1% argument.
Yeah, hence Occupy.
Which was a good thing, because Occupy was able to point out to people all over America that the rich are richer than ever before, and the poor and the rest of us are not so good.
The rest of us are not so good. It's very difficult to find a job to sustain one's family at material levels to which we had become accustomed. Now, that's a whole different discussion. We can save that for another day.
Well, I'm not sure, because I just looked in the newspaper, the New York Times, and I'm discovering that European countries like, for example, the Netherlands, Germany, France, all are paying a minimum wage, which is way, way higher than in the United States. And all of them are relatively prosperous, though they have issues.
Yes. What I don't want this to devolve into is a big discussion on how we all need to live more simply. Let's just stipulate, yes, we all need to live more simply.
Well, we're talking about, the fact that the environment and that the resources are disappearing. You mean like
that? Yes, indeed.
We're not going to talk about that.
Yeah, I'd like to talk more about the structural changes that happened to the economy in the wake of the crash of 2008 and the situation we're in now, in which levels of income equality are at or in excess of those that existed during the Gilded Age of the late 1800s.
I love the Gilded Age.
Do you? Why? Tell me why you love the Gilded Age. Because Mark Twain.
Yeah.
Tell us a little about the Gilded Age and why we should be so alarmed that we're in a new one.
Well, at that time, it was considered normal for ordinary working people to move from job to job, or if they were lucky enough to have a permanent job, to accept whatever wages were offered. When an employer didn't make as much money as the employer wanted to, they simply lowered the wages, and you had the choice of being fired or accepting the lowered wages. The response to that over the years was to attempt to create organized labor, that is, labor that would unite and make demands for a living wage, and sometimes go on strike. Those strikes were then broken by cooperation of the government and large corporations and outfits and private police outfits like the Pinkertons.
Like the Pinkertons. Okay. How concentrated was wealth? How was wealth distributed during the Gilded Age?
It was very unconcentrated. There was a very relatively small upper class that held the largest part of the economic pie. And there was a middle class beginning to develop, professional people, and so on. And there was a large number of farmers and working people who were really basically the working class and were totally worked at the will and whim of these powerful owners of factories and mines and resources.
Who believed themselves to be the job creators, who extended the great boon of employment to the unworthy masses, who ought to be grateful that they even have a job, right?
Yeah.
So it doesn't matter that those people had to work 16-hour days, or that their children had to work, or that there were no safety standards whatsoever, and their wages were meager at best. Those people should still just be grateful, right?
Right.
Right.
And at the same time, in this Gilded Age, particularly toward the end of it, a movement called progressivism developed, which was essentially a movement to try to get economic justice for working people. And it was a popular movement. In those days, print media was the only media. Mm-hmm. And there were magazines like McClure's and others with great articles indicating, for example, how corrupt and nasty Standard Oil was, which still is there and still is there.
Right.
And all of these articles, all of these discussions, including a book by Mark Twain called The Gilded Age, mm-hmm. all of that criticism had some impact. You had reforms. You had Teddy Roosevelt even and Taft, who was a president to follow Roosevelt, and even Wilson, who was the president after that, who promised to continue the progressive movement. What Wilson did instead was eventually drag us into World War I, which created the chaos which led to eventually the re-rise of Germany in the form of Nazism.
Right. And he also helped create the League of Nations, but the Senate said, no, we don't want to join it.
Yeah, right.
Okay, but that's a different story. This is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Program. 503-231-8187 is the number to call. You can also offer comments on our Facebook page, facebook.com/Abe and Joe. Like us while you're there, because we need to be liked.
Do we need to be liked?
We do need to
be
liked.
I don't care to be liked, actually. I don't care whether people like me or not. I don't, as long as they don't shoot me or beat me up or steal my clothes.
Oh, well, that would be
why bad. Would anyone steal my clothes?
No, good Lord. They'd steal them and they go, oh, God, please take these back.
Yeah, right.
All right. So we're talking about the crash of 2008. We're talking about the new Gilded Age. And we're going to, as we go on in the program today, talk about what we can do to remedy the situation that we find ourselves in. And we're also going to look at the concerted effort to undo the labor gains that you just talked about and to undo President Roosevelt's New Deal.
Yeah, and I also want to close in on the fact that what we have today politically in the United States, in the context of this, is something we didn't have previously to the degree we have it, which is a two-party system in which one of the party's sole objective is to make it impossible for the other party to accomplish anything.
Indeed.
And that is bizarre.
That is really bizarre. Even childish.
And on top of that, the Democratic president, in whom everyone had, I think, inordinate faith, is a compromiser who compromises. What's the line they use about him? He punts at the first down.
He punts on first down. Yeah.
Yeah. And that is really true. And it's unfortunate because what was needed was a powerful, really, really, really powerful figure like Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
Yeah. We needed another FDR. And
we didn't
Obama
get it.
Is not that. No.
Yeah.
All right, well, let's go to the phones.
Okay.
Who's Mark? Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for a great discussion. Oscar Wilde said that people, and I think he was referring to or thinking of Americans, know the price of everything and the value of nothing.
Yes.
I'd like to focus on the ways in which civil society is fighting back. There's a website, www.alternativetrademandate.org.
Mm-hmm.
People can download a 20-page mandate from 50 NGOs on how states should be able to resist banking deregulation and speculation, which, of course, is opposite to the TTIP and the TAFTA, the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, which protects investors and really allows an assault on public sector jobs and the environment, fracking moratoriums, minimum wage, everything. Even the Berlin Philharmonic is probably
not the Berlin Philharmonic.
Well, I mean, everyone has to get a subsidy according to this TTIP, you know, and you can't privilege You can't really allow a public sector. I'd strongly recommend the writings of Henry Giroux, who is from Canada, and he can be found on truthout.org. And he insists that profit maximization is really the end of imagination.
That's an interesting it's an interesting phrase. It may be true.
Yes, and it's so bizarre that our government is so efficient in protecting the 1% and just pretending that the financial meltdown never occurred.
Well, you know, one
shifting the responsibility and the cost to wage earners.
One of the things I think is really important to understand is that Americans, and I think people in general, have no real knowledge of current or even recent past history. So, for example, when we have huge numbers of desperate children coming to the United States, nobody says, gee, we destroyed the government and the system in El Salvador. Gee, we destroyed government and system in Honduras, and so on, and led those states into incredible violence and horror, and allowed the dope trade to flourish therein. And because we don't understand that, a lot of people, particularly people who are bent toward a kind of racist perception of people south the border, become enraged and frightened and begin to believe weird stuff like, oh, all those people down there are diseased and they're coming here with their diseases.
Well, clearly.
The fact that Charlie Rose can have Dick Cheney on his program last week indicates that the mainstream is really rotten and that we need to really focus on the critical journalism, critical websites, like BuzzFlash.com and many, many others.
Yeah, there are lots of them, but those are good ones.
KBOO.FM.
I uploaded a 15-page article this morning titled Learning from Roosevelt by Stefan Schulmeister, who is an Austrian economist. And I put this on LA Indie Media and TomHartman.com. 45,000 schools were created, 7,800 bridges were built, the Civilian Conservation Corps almost immediately brought hope to 500,000 young persons. I think the idea of transferring work from seniors to young people is very exciting, and reducing working hours, which is really the only way to assure people of the right to work, and not just a paper chase.
No, I think you're right, and I really appreciate your call. I want to give others the opportunity.
Hey, thanks very much. Now, he just mentioned Franklin Roosevelt, and that's a good segue here because this is something I want to toss into our conversation. So during the last Gilded Age, we saw these movements to empower working people. And
women and minorities, even.
And minorities, and really for the first time in our history to create a large and viable middle class. There was a big crash after the last Gilded Age, it led to a little something you might have heard of called the Great Depression. Heard of that?
Yeah.
Okay, good. Now, how do we get out of the Great Depression? Opinions are divided on this, but really pretty much both sides are true. One camp says, well, mobilizing for the war economy of in the Second World War pulled us out of the Great Depression. That is true. That is also true that under President Franklin Roosevelt, a systematic program of investment in infrastructure and labor began in this country called the New Deal. And that also pulled us out of the Great Depression. Now, how did this work? Essentially, what Roosevelt did is he looked around the country, saw that a lot of stuff needed to be built. I'm very simplifying here, of course. And he started paying Americans to build it. All of a sudden, people had jobs. All of a sudden, they had money to spend. All of a sudden, their income became everybody else's income, because that's how the economy works. Your income is my income, is the guy next door's income, and so on and so forth. And when everybody is working and when everybody is making a decent wage, that's when the economy does well, not when wealth is concentrated and income is concentrated at the very highest levels. That is not an efficient, prosperous economy.
Yeah, and in fact, it's interesting because the great criticism of the attempts by Roosevelt to improve the economy rests on the fact that in 1937 there was a recession again, but that really happened when the government stopped providing the money for the various programs, or limited the amount of money available for the various programs that were creating those jobs and creating that infrastructure and so on.
Yeah, and so immediately the economy took a U-turn and started heading down the tubes again. Mm-hmm. This is when Roosevelt listened to his wealthy advisors instead of continuing with what had been working.
Well, and another thing that people just don't seem to understand today, and the Republican economists and the dominant economists of many sorts, Hayek and so on, keep forgetting that in the old formulations that we learned in school of economies, supply and demand, the concept of supply and demand. Demand is the other half, the key half. You can have all kinds of stuff, but if people can't afford to buy it, it's not going to be an economy that's viable.
Right, exactly. Now, the dominant economic paradigm that has dictated policy in this country really since the Reagan era is completely the opposite of that. It's called supply-side economics. I'm sure you've heard of this, right? George H.W. Bush, when he ran for president against Ronald Reagan, called this voodoo economics, one of the more prescient and accurate characterizations in recent history, because he's absolutely correct when he says it's voodoo. Because it really doesn't work. Supply side.
Well, but voodoo does work. Never mind.
Yeah, voodoo totally works.
Yeah.
Supply side economics dictates that if you reduce taxes and regulations on the supply side of the economy, meaning producers of stuff, providers of services, that those people will be able to use their newfound freedom and their extra money to invest in creating jobs for everybody. So you cut taxes somehow, or you cut taxes on the wealthy, somehow their business grows, somehow tax revenues actually increase, even though you've just cut tax rates, and somehow everything, wealth trickles down to the masses and everybody's happy. Well, as it turns out, under the supply side paradigm, stuff trickles down, but it ain't money. If you know what I'm saying.
I understand. No, it's really true.
We could do a little thought experiment to prove why this doesn't work, okay? So, Joe, you're a factory owner.
I'm a factory owner.
You make widgets.
I make a very good widget.
You make a really damn good widget.
I got a widget to blow your mind.
Problem is, right now, the economy's in really bad shape.
Yeah.
Nobody's got money for widgets.
Yeah.
You're wishing really that you could sell more widgets.
Yeah.
You're really wondering what you're going to do.
Yeah. Lay off my workers.
Yeah, you probably laid off some of your workers because, well, people aren't buying widgets, right? So along comes the government and says, Joe, we've got a cure. We're going to cut your taxes.
Yay.
So you've just gotten a big tax cut. You've got a few extra million dollars in your pocket. What are you going to do with it?
Oh, I'll put it in the bank and get interest.
Wait, aren't you going to create jobs?
No.
I thought you were a job creator.
Well, no. See, that isn't true.
We just cut your taxes, job creator. Why aren't you creating jobs?
Because I can make for sure money by investing in the stock market and in the banks.
Or maybe you can build a factory someplace where you don't have to pay your workers very much.
Yeah, I like Honduras for that.
Yeah. In the meantime, is anybody buying widgets?
No, because they can't afford them.
No, because they don't have any jobs. They don't have any money.
Yeah.
That is the myth of the job creators. That is the myth of supply side economics.
Well, and you know what really blows my mind is the degree to which this it's sort of analogous but not the same as the fantasy of the 6-day creation of the universe or the 6,000 year existence of all of humankind and the dinosaurs, you know, humans riding on dinosaurs and stuff like that. Alley-oop,
yeah,
kind of.
Right. It's accepted as gospel truth, but there's really no evidence to suggest it actually works.
Well, actually, there's evidence to suggest that it actually doesn't work.
So what Roosevelt did was stimulate the demand side of the economy.
Well, he was able to do this because Congress, Republican and Democratic, was frightened, terribly frightened.
Oh, yes.
And this was an era when fascist dictatorships were beginning to appear all over Europe.
This was a period where the ruling class realized that they'd better do something to fix things or the pitchforks and the torches were coming for them.
Right.
I submit we are at a similar state right now.
But no pitchforks, no torches.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's interesting.
That's interesting. So that is the difference between supply-side economics, demand-side economics. One works, the other does not. And when President Obama came into office in 2008, there was a cry, there was a clamor. You heard it on this very program, for the creation of another new deal to put Americans back to work, rebuilding our crumbling infrastructure, building new infrastructure for the 21st century, doing all these things that are long overdue that really need to be done, which would have the ancillary benefit, not really the ancillary benefit, but the principal benefit of putting Americans to work, putting money in their pockets so they could spend it and invigorate the economy.
And what's really ironic is all that infrastructure created in the 30s really is now decayed and needs to be replaced. We need so many things. We need a high-speed rail system. We need repairs to bridges and highways. We need new school buildings. We need all kinds, all manner of publicly supported projects that could make our economy much more efficient, much more effective, and provide jobs for thousands upon thousands of people.
Thousands upon thousands of people. So here we were in 2008, on the edge of the abyss. President Obama is swept into office. He has a plan to start another new deal, but it never really happens. Or rather, more accurately, what happens is far too anemic.
I'm not sure I don't know. I don't know that he had an adequate plan. I think what mainly he did was help the banks.
Yeah, he did help the banks, that must be said. His stimulus plan was a big step in the right direction. And in the estimation of Paul Krugman and a number of other estimable economists, probably saved us from a second Great Depression.
But it was not enough to save jobs, yeah. And it was not enough to save cities, and it was not enough to save a lot of stuff.
It was not neither big enough nor broad enough to do what truly needed to be done. But now is a point at which we have to ask why. And the answer is that the conservative right, the moneyed class in this country, was bound and determined that nothing like the New Deal would ever happen again.
And this is more ideological than practical.
Much more ideological than practical. And you know what? They succeeded. And here we are today. Jobs are stagnant. Wages are stagnant. The middle class is barely hanging on.
Well, wages aren't just stagnant. They're down.
They are down. In real terms, they are down. The middle class is barely hanging on, and the wealthy are doing better than they ever have before.
By the way, I want to mention one thing really briefly. The concept, the middle class, which is an invention. The way it's used, it's an invention of very modern times. We used to say with some pride that I'm a working class person.
Yes.
And the working class in the 1940s and 50s and 60s and 70s were people who had a very good wage. They could afford to buy houses, automobiles, television sets, whatever. And they considered themselves, by and large, at that point, working people. Now suddenly comes this notion of middle classhood. Now, in the old days, middle class was professional people, a relatively small class of people. I just wanted to mention that because now we perverted the language so thoroughly that the working class is now called the middle class, and there is, in our fantasy, no working class.
That's right. But I think we can probably use the two interchangeably, right?
Well, we can get away with it.
Yeah, we can get away with it. Okay, we're going to go to the phones here in just a second. But before I do that, I want to pronounce the second great economic secret. Are you ready for it?
I'm ready.
The first was, it all works because we believe it will work.
Right.
The second great economic secret is this. You remember what we just talked about, demand-side economics, about putting people to work and putting money into their pockets?
Yeah.
Here's the second big secret. The middle class is the source of a prosperous American economy, not the result of a prosperous American economy.
How do you mean?
How do I mean? This is what I mean. The rich would have you believe that if you're nice to them, if you cut their taxes, then the economy will do better, mm-hmm. and that the middle class, as a result, will grow and flourish. That is entirely bass-ackwards. The truth is that if you put money to work, if you tax the rich at a robust rate and you invest that money in jobs and in infrastructure, that's how the economy prospers and the middle class prospers.
And so do the rich, ironically.
And so do the rich, ironically. Maybe they don't have quite so much money, but they do pretty damn good.
Well, they've never done poorly in this country.
So to speak, yeah.
All right, let's go to the phones. 231-8187.
Michael, good morning.
Hello.
Hey.
Hi. So
now, Michael, we're gonna try to keep the 3-minute rule because it's hard to do, but we're gonna try.
Yeah, I know. And as the person who caused you to bring in the rule, I know you.
No, it wasn't just you.
Yeah, clock's ticking, Michael.
Go for it.
Okay, subprime mortgages. The whole thing was caused by subprime mortgages. I have this thing, I have this information from a book called Reckless Endangerment by Gretchen Morgenson,
who
I heard
on
C-SPAN. Mm-hmm. And then she's a New York Times financial reporter and mm-hmm. one other fellow whose name I can't remember offhand. So here's how the whole thing started. It was subprime mortgages. What's a subprime mortgage? A subprime mortgage is you give a loan to somebody who statistics and actuarial information tell you is quite unlikely to be able to pay it back.
Yeah.
That's what makes it subprime.
Mm-hmm.
It's a bad deal. Why would you do this? Why would a bank do this?
Here's the answer. You ready?
No.
You just asked the question.
I've got 3 minutes, right?
Okay, go ahead.
Okay, so I'm going to give you my answer.
All right.
So why would a bank want to do this? Well, the answer is that in the late 90s, Bill Clinton and a bunch of other Democrats were dissatisfied with the rate of minority home ownership. And the rate of minority home ownership was low because minorities couldn't qualify for the then very strict mortgage rules. So they loosened the rules in the late 90s. And I got this out of this book, right? This isn't just me.
Okay,
go
ahead.
They loosened the rules,
yeah,
and they created this class of subprime mortgages. So how do you, as a financial institution, how do you deal with the fact that the government is forcing you to lend money to people who aren't going to be able to pay it back? What you do is you bundle those bad mortgages with a bunch of good mortgages, hoping that because the good mortgages will get paid back and is not that high of a proportion of the bad mortgages in these bundles, then the whole thing is still worth money because the whole thing, which is a mortgage derivative, will still pay off. So they did this. And what it depended on was that the people with the good mortgages would continue to pay. So when the recession hit in like 2007, when things started to go downhill there, all of a sudden the good mortgage people couldn't pay either. Enough of them couldn't pay either. And the thing was so brittle and fragile that it crashed. So that's what happened. It started because the mortgage quality was weakened by Bill Clinton and the Democrats to be able to make minorities afford a home that they couldn't actually afford. That's the original cause of the huge crash we had in
yes.
the financial industry.
Yeah, I remember when all the black and brown people crashed the economy. Remember that, Joe?
Hey, you know what? Yeah. You're being sarcastic.
Yeah, I am being sarcastic,
but you know
Michael.
What? You're being sarcastic because you don't have a good answer.
Yeah, I sure do. Thank you for calling. Here's my answer. Go ahead, Joe.
Please. Oh, no, you want to give him an answer?
Here's my answer. It is true that under Bill Clinton in the 1990s, that a very important restriction on the activities of bankers was undertaken. That was essentially the dissolution of the Glass-Steagall Act. You heard of this?
Yeah.
The Glass-Steagall Act said, in essence, that there are two primary spheres of banking activity, right? There is what they call commercial banking, which is basically the making of loans.
Mm-hmm.
It's what you and I do every day. We have a checking account, we have a savings account, maybe we got a mortgage, maybe we got a credit card. That's commercial banking. The other side is investment banking. That's when money is taken and invested in stocks, in bonds, in futures.
In potentially risky stuff.
In potentially risky stuff, yes. This is something that investment houses do, that banks do. But usually, or in the past, before the dissolution of Glass-Steagall, never the twain should meet. There was a clear line drawn between these two spheres of activities because regulators realized from experience that if banks started dipping their toes in all of this stuff, that they were probably going to use some of the money, the more guaranteed, more solid money on the commercial side of things to support their higher risk, higher reward activities on the investment side.
Which is exactly what happened in the Great Depression.
Which is exactly what happened in the Great Depression, and which is why the Glass-Steagall Act was put into place in the first place. Now, this was deregulated under Bill Clinton and the Congress of the 1990s, and this is when we begin to see the blurring of that once strong line between commercial and investment banking. This is when we begin to see banks dabbling in all kinds of things that banks didn't used to dabble in, that only investment houses used to dabble in.
Right.
One of these things was the creation of mortgage derivatives, which didn't just happen to support subprime mortgages, as Michael suggested. They happened because they were a new and exciting way to make a whole bunch of money that only existed because the barrier between commercial and investment banking had been struck down.
Yeah, and I do think it's important, though, to acknowledge the fact that it was Bill Clinton and his administrations and the support of a coalition of Republicans and Democrats that did do away with the Glass-Steagall Act. And I think that, we need to understand Bill Clinton's lack of understanding both of class structure and of economics. And I want to give our caller that.
Okay, fair enough. But one more comment before we go back to the phones. Now, it is true that during the period prior to the crash of 2008, a whole bunch of loans were made to people, subprime loans, these are called by some, made to people who couldn't really afford to pay them back. And they were done, as I stated earlier, because in the short term and in the minds of myopic investors, it really didn't matter because you could make a whole bunch of cash trading these derivatives that were made out of the mortgages that happened in the first place. This is what happens in the unholy, incestuous alliance between commercial and investment banking. This is what happens in a deregulated financial environment. This is why we need tight controls on how money is spent and invested in this country.
Okay, on that note, let's go to the phone. 231-8187.
BJ, good morning. BJ, you got to turn down your radio. All right, let's try Barth.
Good morning, fellas.
Good morning.
You have to allow more time for your adoring public to speak to you.
Yes.
On the subprime mortgage bit, the idea of that people were unable to pay and that that crashed the economy is a little bit simplistic. To be fair, the banks sought the borrowers out. I mean, there were literally people standing on the sidewalk saying, hey, you want to buy a house? You want to buy a house? Come on, let's talk about it. Let's buy a house.
Oh, yeah.
And so when they did that, the banks first got paid for writing the loan. Mm-hmm. The person coming in had nothing to lose, said, hey, you know, I can step up. I can have a house. I can have my dreams. Or, you know, I can pay the same as I'm paying for rent and have a house. But the banks got paid. They got paid for having the house appraised. They got paid for writing the paperwork. They got paid every time. And then the bank went to AIG and took out a full value insurance policy on the loan.
Right.
So they hoped, and it's proven in congressional hearings, that the banks were literally betting against the borrowers and betting against their own customers by saying,
yes,
we're going to get paid anyway, and that money's not going back to the borrower, and that money's not going back to the investor. That's going into the pockets of management.
And they had the collusion of the audit houses who gave these subprime derivatives a full A-plus credit rating.
Well, and also just bang, bang, bang. I mean, here, you're making $10,000 on this transaction. You got 20 of these a day. Hey, that's a pretty good living. There was a story that five partners, I don't know if they were all men, got together and bought a single house in California for, you know, $120,000, whatever. And then they put a coat of paint on it and mowed the yard and did some landscaping. And then they sold it to each other back and forth five different times. They had the same appraiser come in, and the value went up about $30,000 or $40,000 or $50,000 every time they sold it on paper, because the frenzy was on.
Mm-hmm.
And so at the end of the deal, they had approximately quadrupled the value of the house, tripled or quadrupled the value of the house. It was the same house. It was in the same neighborhood. You know, nothing had changed. And then they walked away with all the money. So they each got paid the full value of the house by the next guy on the loan. And then at the end of this deal, they just kind of walked away, and the bank's holding the paper for, you know, $400,000 on this little house, and there's no payback.
Well, and in fact, the banks had invested the risk in AIG, an insurance company, which it turns out didn't have the money at all.
No.
Right. Well, the big thing about this, you know, even if we talk about strict controls on financial transactions, even loose controls on financial transactions would have prevented most of this stuff. And some of these people should still be rotting in jail, and none of them are.
That's another very, very good point. Listen, thank you so much for the call. I appreciate it.
Bye-bye.
If you really want to understand this situation well, I recommend a Frontline program from PBS from 2009 called Inside the Meltdown. It's archived on pbs.org. You can watch it. It's really brilliant reporting. It'll take you step by step through how all of this happened. It really should be required viewing if you want to understand this topic.
Yeah, I've seen it. It's good.
It's wonderful. All right. Coming up this morning on KBOO at 9, Alternative Radio features Paul Cienfuegos, a regional leader in the community rights movement, which works to dismantle corporate constitutional so-called rights and assert the people's inherent right to self-government. He is helping to establish the Oregon Community Rights Network, which launched in 2013 and is based in Portland. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, Flashpoints features the Electronic Intifada with Nora Barrows Friedman and an interview with Native American activist Kimball Big Horse about being roughed up at the San Francisco Giants Stadium on Native American Heritage Night. At 11, on stage and studio, D.M.A. Roberts talks with Michael Mendelson of the Portland Shakespeare Project about The Tempest at Artist Reps Alder Stage.
It's a very weird play.
His last one. I like it.
It's a weird play.
Yeah. We also hear director Avita Talshira. Avital Shira, talking about Shakespeare's Love's Labor's Lost at Post 5 Theater. And at 11:30 on Art Focus, host Ava Lake interviews encaustic painter Elise Wagner, who currently has a show at Butters Gallery. All this and more coming up today on KBOO.
You know, we do great stuff.
We really do.
And you should all be listening, and you should all be giving us money, vast amounts of money.
Yeah, yeah.
So, sell your children. Give us the money.
We're talking about the Great Recession.
Yes.
We're talking about the attempts to undo the Roosevelt's New Deal and to prevent a new one. And we're talking about where do we go from here.
Well, and we need to understand the odd mix of ideology, this kind of mixture of weird Christian fundamentalism, coupled with an odd mixture of anti-science thinking, coupled with an enormously powerful, very tiny number, 1% of 1% of the people who control most of the capital, most of the money in our society. And how this has become not only perverted, but frighteningly powerful, such that it, you know, it very well could be that the Congress of the United States rolls into a Republican weirdness. This is not your grandma's Republicans. This is not the Eisenhower Republicans. This is not even the Reagan Republicans. This is something totally different. That goes on at the same time that the Democratic Party is afraid to stand up and become a party of the people.
Yeah, you're absolutely correct.
So I'm getting, it's gloomy.
503-231-8187 is the number to call. We're also taking your comments on our Facebook page, facebook.com/AbaJoe. Corey comments, it's the minority's fault for attempting to want houses. It's also clear now. Let's go to the phones. Sunny, good morning.
Good morning. I don't know why you guys have any hope left in the Democratic Party, because I think the Democratic Party long ago left the people under Clinton. When Clinton went after a low-income struggling moms, burn them at the stake, he was showing that he was a company man. He didn't care about anything. And as far as the fundamentalist Christians, they don't have anything in common with Jesus, who basically fed the people around him and advised everyone else to, you know, do
bloody
do it.
Socialist.
Yeah, I give up on the Democrats, you guys. But then the other thing is, I really enjoy KBOO daytime programming, particularly. I think it's excellent in all ways. And I don't think we have any other choice but to create an economy ourselves, because I think the title for the working class would be the desperate class, and I don't know where the middle class is anymore, but I would recommend that before Christmas time, maybe even around Christmas time, everybody get together and find a venue, and all you economic thinkers and the economic callers and everybody else come together and have a convention on a new economy, because we're going to have to do it for ourselves.
And I appreciate that, and I think it's an important idea, but I would point out that over and over again, progressives have united for these very purposes. What stops that from really becoming a movement that advances throughout society is an enormous cultural mythology that seems to dominate the thinking of even the most poor people, blaming the poor, blaming the middle class, essentially exalting the rich and powerful. And there's so much propaganda and so much effort and so much money put into all of this sort of stuff that's really hard to get going. Now, it doesn't mean it's impossible. It just means it's a very great challenge.
Well, I suggest that perhaps everybody get together and different neighborhoods that especially need some impetus be put into a hat, right?
And hat.
Right. And then
the last time they put things in a hat, it became the Mormon religion. Anyway, go ahead.
Well, you draw it out of a hat, and then you say, okay, this section is going to be our little economic focus area. What can we do in this section?
Uh-huh.
And you just do it random, and you just show what a group of people can do. I mean, I don't have high hopes that it's going to save the country necessarily or save the world, but I do think that there is potential, and I think waiting for government, I think government left town a long time ago.
Well,
the Democratic Party.
I think many of your points are good. I think we also need to remember that there is a kind of spontaneous energy that happens. Occupy was not a thing that could have been predicted. It happened. It had impact. The main impact it had was to point out to people clearly who has the money and who does not.
Yes, it did.
Anyway,
all right.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Yeah, I've pretty much given up on the Democratic Party. I haven't been a Democrat for a long time.
Well, I think it's a strategic question. I mean, I think we have very decent, locally here, we have very decent and statewide representation in our Congress. Both our senators and our local Congress people are not all that bad, given the structure that we live in.
The Democrats for a long time have run from their liberal base because for some reason it became a slur to be called a liberal or to have it suggested that the Democratic Party was listening to its liberal base.
Mm-hmm.
And instead they've tried to position themselves as some sort of reasonable centrist sort of compromise party between the far right and the far left. But here's the problem with that, right? If the far right is saying the sky is red and the far left is saying the sky is blue, then being the compromise party that says the sky is purple is just as wrong.
That's a weird analogy, but I will say, yeah, purple rain. I will say that
Prince, the great prophet. Prince.
Yes, I will say that we really have systematically in the society from way back. Discredited and attempted to destroy the left. And
yeah.
I think one of the most interesting things is the reappearance of literature in legitimate economics, pointing out that a left-wing perspective is not just a legitimate perspective, but perhaps the correct perspective.
Indeed. Reality seems to have a liberal bias, doesn't it?
Oh, well, I don't even call it liberal. I'd say left-wing.
503-231-8187. Linda, good morning.
Good morning. I wanted to bring up another aspect of the housing bubble and the crash that got people. I was a appraiser apprentice at the time and just before the crash. And one of the things that really happened was when they made the derivatives from the mortgages, the banks no longer had to care about any actual value of the house. And in fact, everybody cared about running up prices. So mortgage brokers took over financing the houses, and they worked hard to lure people in to buy houses they couldn't afford. I had friends they did. They were giving 120% loans and saying, don't put a down payment. Your equity will go up so fast, you don't need it. And they had run up, quote, equity that fast. They just later took it all away. It was all phony paper equity.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so many people got trapped in what looked like and what was being promoted in the media as the next way to make your money for your retirement and to raise your status up one level was get a house while the prices were going up, but before they had topped, and you were going to have a ton of equity to borrow against. When in truth, they were pressuring appraisers to put the prices higher than they actually warranted for the neighborhood they were in or the economy in, neighborhood, et cetera. So I wanted to bring that in. It was a whole massive attempt to bamboozle the middle class.
You know, I think it's a good example of a conspiracy without a leader, if you follow me.
Well, the leaders were the John Birchers who changed those laws and made it all possible.
I don't know about John Birchers, but it's certainly the conservatives.
They just opened the door to the greed of everyone else.
Yeah. No, I and it's nice to hear from somebody who had some direct experience in that mortgage brokering world.
Yeah, the mortgage brokers made their income as a percentage of the total sale.
Yep.
They had no interest in keeping the value the way it was. In the days before that, banks didn't want to loan more money than could be regained by a sale.
Right. Mm-hmm. And it was understood that it was the lender's responsibility to decide whether or not that loan was a good idea or a bad one. So when I hear people like our caller, Michael, blaming the people who took out these loans that were so aggressively marketed to them, you know, it just comes up short.
Yeah, it comes up real short. And a lot of people who spent their whole lives working very hard are losing all of their future. A lot of them are between 45 and 75. And they don't have a way of recouping the losses. They will never recoup that. So, you know, it's really important how they worked so hard to convince all of us that this was the way we should go. It's like 401ks instead of pensions. They put us in the riskiest
yes.
possible part for our money, and then take it away.
You know, I'm really glad you mentioned the 401k phenomenon and the destruction of pension, guaranteed pensions. I'm going to, I guess we'll go on to somebody else now.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. And she made a really good set of points.
She did make a very good set of points. What can we do about all this? We can continue to push for the creation of jobs via government spending in the model of FDR. We can vote with our dollars. We can buy products that are produced locally by companies who pay their employees a good wage. There's all sorts of things we can do. They may sound insignificant and they may sound incremental, but we do have some power here.
Well, you and I really disagree about this. I think that we're at a crisis point.
Oh, of course we are.
Internationally and
nationally.
Oh, I don't deny that. And I'm not sure. I mean, I look at the upcoming elections, the congressional elections and then the national elections, and look at the kinds of choices we face, which are not unusual, which are not unprecedented in the past. But I see the failure, total failure in the United States, of a wide spectrum of political parties struggling with good ideas or less good ideas in a marketplace of ideas. This is not what's happening. What's happening is vast sums of money, the Koch brothers, et cetera, pouring unlimited amounts of money into the electoral process and totally perverting it. So I don't know.
Oh, yeah, you're absolutely correct.
I don't know. And on top of that, we have a weird national ideology, which seems to be fundamentalist. It's not, you know, it's not Christian. Let's be clear about this. They're not teachings of Jesus. A fundamental kind of reactionary political, social, religious notion that is built on ignorance and is fed on ignorance and is essentially becoming more and more a part of the ordinary life of ordinary Americans.
It's ignorant nationalism is what it is.
Well, yeah.
Yeah. The other things we can do is throw our support behind state and local measures that are doing the right thing. Look at the minimum wage in Seattle, recently raised to $15 an hour. That is absolutely the sort of thing we need to be doing. That is a measure that directly puts more money into the hands of people who need it the most, who will spread that wealth around the community. California is on the verge of doing the same thing.
Right. And we look at these European countries who have their problems, but in fact have a guaranteed minimum wage that means you can make a living in an ordinary job.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. Another thing we can do is legalize pot.
What? What does that got to do with it?
You can make all sorts of money for your state government, which you can in turn invest in education and
infrastructure. Chocolate-covered marijuana will solve all things?
No, but it'll raise us a hell of a lot of money that we could really use right now.
I don't know, man.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not opposed to legalizing marijuana, but I don't see it as a panacea for anything.
No, it's not a panacea, but it would certainly help. And I think as more states see the windfall that's cascading over Colorado and will soon fall upon Washington, they'll start doing the same thing.
Yeah, it's like legalizing gambling, legalizing alcohol. These are minor helps to economies. Marijuana, I mean, it's another agricultural product. It might have a future.
Yeah, people might like it.
People might like it.
All right, let's get one more phone call in. Nope, no more time.
We're out of time. Oh my goodness, and we didn't solve any problems.
No, it seems like we rarely do.
Yeah. Stay tuned. Well, KBOO, fighting for you, for real.
Thanks for the discussion today. We'll be back at you next week.
Community Radio and the Clinton Street Theater are proud to co-sponsor The Bloom, a journey through transformational festivals, showing Thursday, July 10th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater.
Amidst the global crisis of a dysfunctional old paradigm, a new renaissance of human culture is underway. The Bloom illuminates the blossoming phenomenon of transformational festivals, immersive participatory realities that are having profound, life-changing effects on hundreds of thousands of lives.
That's The Bloom, Thursday, July 10th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater. For more information, go to the KBOO website.
Good morning. You're listening to KBOO Portland. It's 9 o'clock. Here's what's coming up this morning on KBOO. First, Alternative Radio features Paul Cienfuegos, a regional leader in the community rights movement, which works to dismantle corporate constitutional so-called rights and assert the people's inherent right to self-government. He is helping to establish the Oregon Community Rights Network, which launched in 2013 and is based in Portland, Oregon. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, Flashpoints features the Electronic Intifada with Noro Barrows Friedman and an interview with Native American activist Kimball Bighorse about being roughed up at the San Francisco Giants Stadium on Native American Heritage Night. At 11, on Stage and Studio, host D'Mae Roberts talks with Michael Mendelson of the Portland Shakespeare Project about The Tempest at Artist Reps Alder Stage. We also hear director Avital Shira talking about Shakespeare's Love's Labor's Lost at Post 5 Theater. And at 11:30 on Art Focus, host Ava Lake interviews encaustic painter Elise Wagner, who currently has a show at Butters Gallery. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support for Community Radio. If you are not a current member,